yet I must also admit that I was truly fascinated by the exposure of this technology and by finding out that these people are even more hard-headed than I am, that they're really seriously into just either the signal detection of the most sophisticated kind and without going in for the science fiction and the flaky stuff, they're just level-headed about to say, let's go out there and listen. It all reminds me when I was a little kid, my grandma had a wonderful conch shell, and she told me that if I hold this up to my ear, I can hear the sea. And sure enough, I held this up to my ear, and I could hear something. Of course, it was noise, and I know now, but at that stage, it boggled my mind, and it really led me to ask all kinds of questions about what really is doing this. And in a way, I can see that perhaps that's what the SETI project is all about in the first instance. And let's pick up every possible seashell and listen to it and see what we find. So at this stage, let me open it to questions. Is anybody? Yes.
I have two questions for you, Dr. Tata. The first thing is Senator Bryan with the killing of the HRMS. What was the actual story behind that? And why was it cancelled all of a sudden? Sort of one day it was there and one day it wasn't.
Senator O'Brien had tried to kill it the year before and had been outmaneuvered by members of the Congress who were strong supporters of the project. He, in the intervening year, became a far cleverer politician, and he actually orchestrated this quite well. An 11th hour attack on the NASA budget after 3 days of debate where they decided not to cancel the space station and not to cancel the advanced solid rocket motor booster. And he gave them an amendment that they could vote on real easily. Senator Mikulski, who supported it very strongly, claimed that she just couldn't fight the giggle factor. What can I tell you? The Congress is not necessarily... I will say that in the American Congress currently we have more former undertakers than scientists or engineers. So they are not perhaps the most technologically literate group.
What was the second question?
Second question is there any chance that NASA are going to be able to fund HRMS again?
Well, certainly we've certainly had a very large change in our congressional, you know, our government's change like yours has recently. And the current atmosphere looks rather dismal for basic science research. We're looking at large cuts in the ongoing NASA budget and the National Science Foundation as well, perhaps. In the face of a political necessity, apparently, of fully funding the space station. So I think there's going to be quite a bit of space science that goes unfunded, and I don't think it's very likely, until we're successful, that NASA will get back in the SETI game.
Thank you. Yes.
Is the signal that we're intending to get back being beamed like we're doing out to a specific place, or is it a background signal from the planet that we're looking for?
It could be either. First of all, we're not beaming any signals. We are leaking a whole lot of radiation. And all we can do is say it depends on how much power is in the leakage, whether we could detect it or not. It's much easier for us to detect a signal that was intended for us because they put a lot of gain behind it and they focused it towards the sun. But let me just give you some benchmarks, and you can make your own decision. In terms of our technology, which is undoubtedly the most primitive technology that can engage in this kind of activity, if you take our most numerous transmitters on the surface of the planet that leak out all the time, it's your commercial FM and television broadcast stations, about 10 megawatts of effective isotropic radiated power. Our system could find that equivalent to the distance of the nearest star, but no further. If you say, all right, not our most numerous transmitters, but what's our strongest transmitter that our technology can produce? That has an equivalent isotropic radiated power of 10 to the 14 watts. It's the planetary radar associated with the large dish in Arecibo. And our system could find that much power out halfway to the center of the galaxy. So if they have leakage, which is stronger than the kind of leakage we have, then there's a possibility that we could detect unintended transmissions. It's much more likely that something that has enough power for us to detect would be an intentional transmission.
If we detect the signal out wherever we're searching, how long does it take for that to get back to us, that information?
Ah, great question. We measure in astronomy, we measure distance in light years. Okay, the distance that light travels in 1 year, 6 trillion miles. Radio waves travel at the speed of light. They're electromagnetic radiations, just like light. So if the star, the nearest star to us, is 4.3 light years away, then it would take their signal 4.3 light years to get here. And if we decided to say something in return, that would take another 4.3 light years to get back. So that's 8.6 for a round trip. You know, it's not exactly a snappy conversation. Our most distant target is 155 light years away. So when we talk about communication with extraterrestrial intelligence, we probably have to think more in terms of it being one way rather than two way. And a good analog would be the writings of the ancient Greeks and Romans, or Shakespeare. We learn a lot from what they told us, even though we can't ask questions because of the time barrier.
Yes, something.
You said that there are satellites at the moment being placed in orbit that have allowed a static. Have you discussed with NASA about reducing the amount of static that their satellites are?
Yeah, it's an ongoing discussion, and it's not just with NASA, it's worldwide. There's a thing called the International Telecommunications Union, and over the past 30 years, actually pieces of the spectrum have been allocated by international treaty to different usages so that everybody kind of gets their fair share. And the radio astronomers, as passive users of the spectrum, have been at the table trying to protect the windows that they want to listen to the universe on. However, there's been a change or an acceleration in the use of the spectrum. And even in the States, well, I guess it started in New Zealand. I mean, we're selling the spectrum now. We're auctioning it off to emerging technologies. So there's... we're fighting a losing battle. The U.S. government, okay, following a model that was developed in New Zealand, has actually taken portions of the electromagnetic spectrum, which had previously been allocated in our country for military use but wasn't being used, and they said, okay, all of you guys who want to put up cellular phone networks and low Earth orbiting digital direct broadcast television and sound broadcast. Here's chunks of the spectrum. Who's the highest bidder? Here's your licenses.
Is there a price on this option? What's the price of what they go for?
The expectation. Okay, it hasn't been fulfilled yet. The process is ongoing. It hasn't happened yet. But the expectation was $1 billion a megahertz.
Yes, I'm there.
What sort of problems do you have? Hardware problems, software problems?
Yes.
Do your boards go down?
Yes. We've had all kinds of problems, and they're getting less every day. I mean, this is a young system. We inherited it from NASA after our experience at Arecibo, and then we proceeded to double it and change the design, because engineers can never just replicate something. They have to make it better. So we've had problems with the remote telescope at MOPRA. Switches somehow get set in the middle of the night, and we lose power, and amplifiers go funny, and our software has been the stablest of the system. Really strange. It's usually the software that really bites you. The worst it's done is the network connectivity has gotten overloaded. We've had to rethink that a bit. But the hardware, yeah. Boards, we lose chips on boards. There's been a lot of thunder and lightning out at parks recently. The power in rural power distribution is not as stable as you would like. We have glitches, and that causes a lot of havoc. We go from mains power to generators, diesel generators, to protect us through lightning storms. And when you make that switch over, sometimes it doesn't go well. Sometimes the air conditioner goes, oh, too much, I give up. And then the boards get hot, and then you have trouble. So lots of things. It's a learning experience.
It's just a small comment and a question. Given that this is the centenary of Marconi, anything within the pretty the range that you're looking for planets that might have already been to us here. The question is, how would they, and the reverse question is, of course, how would we decipher the sort of noise that would be coming from electronic door openers and televisions and radio sets and everything else? How would we, from that, pick out something
Well, the kind of thing that we would decipher, that we would first detect, are any embedded coherent components of the broader modulated signals that you're talking about. And then you go looking to see what the encoding mechanism is. It may be a series of narrowband signals that point you to a certain region of the spectrum, and then you try and find out is
suppose we decide to send a signal to another star and we want to encode some information on that. What sort of information?
Okay. The question is, suppose we wanted to send a message to another star. How would we do it in terms of encoding, and what would we say? First of all, let me say we've made a policy statement that Phoenix is a project. If a signal is detected, will not respond until there is some global consensus. And we've done more than just make a policy statement. We've actually written white papers that will be introduced by India in the next session to the Committee on the Peaceful Uses of Outer Space of the United Nations, asking this body, which is the only global body we could find, to begin to think about who might speak for Earth and what might they say. Do we speak with one voice? Do we speak with many? We've had a couple of experiments with that. You may be aware that the Voyager spacecraft, the two Voyager 1 and 2, actually contain a record, the digital encoding of the sights and sounds of Earth. All right, it's first the Secretary of the General of the United Nations saying hello, and then I can't remember how many different languages people saying hello, and then music from all around the world, and video images. And it's really amazing. We lied through our teeth. We don't have anybody who's ugly or sick or hungry. There's no war. There's no poverty. Everything is beautiful. This was the picture of ourselves that we transmitted. A little less information dense, but a very good exercise is something we did at Arecibo in 1974 when we threw out the chicken wire and put in these shiny new panels. We had to have a dedication. Governor of Puerto Rico helicoptered in, which meant that set, when he could come, set the time for the dedication, which meant that we were going to transmit a message. That was the stunt that was done for the dedication. So that meant that set what was overhead at Arecibo, and it's a globular cluster, right, which is 40,000 light years away. Wasn't your prime target, but politically, that's what we ended up with. And this was a really interesting, it's a fun message. If anybody is teaching information theory or wants to play with this, it's really fun. We transmitted on two closely spaced frequencies from the planetary radar. And we used a binary code. So we were either transmitting on this frequency or that frequency. And so if you were receiving only one of them, the thing would go on and off. So you'd have ones and zeros. We transmitted a string of ones and zeros We transmitted it twice. Twice was important because that means that you know that you got the whole message, that you just haven't gotten into the middle of something, right? And the total number of bits was the product of two prime numbers. In anybody's mathematics, prime numbers are prime numbers. Now, what do you do with two prime numbers? Maybe if you're used to seeing visual images in two dimensions, you think about making columns and rows, or rows and columns. There are two ways to do it, so it's not unambiguous. One way looks completely random. Another way is clearly not random. So we transmitted a message that started with a binary counting lesson. Took us up to 6. Carbon atom. I'm 12. Let's see. I can't. I shouldn't try and reconstruct this in my head. I'm not actually sure how many numerals we gave it, how many binary. Then we did the carbon atom. There's a representation of the DNA double helix molecule and an indication of the number of base pairs, nucleotides. There's a picture of a human, a stick representation, and our height is given in the number of wavelengths of the transmitted message. Picture of the telescope that sent the message, representation of the solar system with the third planet sort of moved out of line pointing at the human, kinds of things like this. An interesting amount of information and slightly over 1,700 bits. I think it's 1,759, but somebody ought to check that, but that's the product of two prime numbers.
If I understand it correctly, you are trying to listen in the window, in our own noise. How can you be sure what you're listening for? It's not the window in their noise. Why should their noise be different from our noise?
Why will they not have polluted their same naturally quiet window with their own technology? It's a good question. There are some... I was going to try and look for the graph that shows the quiet window in the spectrum. I mean, this is what nature provides us. Everybody in the galaxy has this same background radiation to work with. This is where it's quiet. But of course, this is where our technology is changing the game and making it noisy. So why might it not be the case that they've polluted their own spectrum as well? Well, they might have. But they also probably have radio astronomers who want to study the universe at those frequencies, and they might have observatories on the far sides of their moon. They might have radio quiet facilities. They might have radio loud facilities somewhere else for transmitting so they can keep quiet windows. Yes, we don't know. We're trying something that maybe in our infinite wisdom 100 years from now we'll look back and laugh at and say, oh, how could we be so foolish? But an advanced technology probably isn't as leaky as we are. They probably do a better job of keeping their excess transmissions, their unwanted transmissions. We don't have to mess up the spectrum as much as we do. It takes just a little engineering and some additional filtering and a little more money for the commercial products that you're developing, and you can clean up a whole lot of the spectrum and still have a lot of use of it. Maybe they're a little bit aesthetically better at their use of the spectrum. Can't answer the question. I really can't. We try and do this without all the anthropomorphical biases that we obviously have. Start by looking at what the universe does. We're guessing. We're trying to make systematic searches of certain hypotheses.
Yeah. What sort of future funding or financial arrangements are you making to support your
program? Oh, well, when I came to Australia, as far as I knew, I was going to fall off a cliff at the end of June because we had gone and raised the money that it would take to do the Australian campaign. since I've been here, the folks at the SETI Institute have been very diligent in terms of trying to continue to raise funding. We do have funding for another year. We have not so far made any progress on what we would like to do, which is to establish a significant endowment. Something, and significant is really what's needed, something on the order of $100 million, so that the annual income from that can keep this sort of research going as long as it needs to. So we finally get into a funding modality which matches the reality that this may be a generational or long-term project. So we haven't had any success at that yet. We are trying, and I think we will be successful. It's just going to take a little longer than it did to get the first $7.5 million.
Just two quick questions. The first part with regard to the funding, whereabouts are you getting it?
Okay. This was a catastrophic cancellation, right? Nobody saw it coming. And so we needed a lot of money quickly if we were to come and take advantage of this Australian deployment opportunity. There's only one way you can do that. You can't do it by a grassroots campaign. As popular as this idea may be with many people around the world, if you have to do it quickly, you've got to go talk to billionaires. And that's what we did. So we have a small number of very, very wealthy and visionary contributors.
The second question is, when anyone talks about looking for extraterrestrial life, why do we always assume that they must be more intelligent than we are?
Ah, that's a statistical argument. Okay, and it has to do with the age of the galaxy. Basically, we've had a technology, it's taken us 3.8 billion years to get from that first microfossil life to telescope building. Okay, of that 3.8 billion years, we've had technology such as you would deem talking about for this purpose is for 100 years for round numbers. Okay. There are stars in the galaxy younger and older than our sun. It's quite possible that lots of life around many of these stars is still in that billions of years it takes to go, it apparently takes, or it took in our case, to go from microfossils to advanced technology. But it's inconceivable in terms of a statistical argument that they could have a technology but it would be younger than 100 years when you're dealing with these billions of years timescale. So if there's a technology out there, it's more advanced than ours. Now, if everybody that develops a technology in a very short time uses it to destroy themselves, which is a scenario that is not implausible for the Earth, then there's nobody out there for us to find. On the other hand, if you found a signal, even a dial tone, no information content, don't have to worry with the cryptographers. All you've got is a dial tone. You still learn an enormous amount by inference. You learn that it's possible for somebody to survive for long times, because on average, they have to have a long lifetime for us to succeed in our primitive searching.
Very profound point. Second last question there.
I just wondering, do you think that our fundamental understanding of the laws of the universe at the moment is sufficient to be able to do searches like this, or do you see the fundamental research that's been done by people like Hawking leading to paths would be more efficient at searching the universe?
It's certainly clear that our understanding of physics in the universe is not complete. There are lots of stuff that we don't know, but you can't do what you can't conceive. So we're essentially working with the knowledge base that we have. I mean, I think it, I always think astronomers should be humble people. We're not. I mean, we're arrogant as hell. But I mean, when you stand up and tell an audience, as maybe Rachel will in a couple of weeks, that, We study this universe and we understand all this sort of stuff, but hey, by the way, there's 90% of the matter out there that we can't account for. I think there's a lot yet to be learned. And again, 100 years from now, we may laugh at our current assessment of the physics and the nature of the interstellar medium and how signals propagate and what makes a good transmission medium for messages across interstellar distances. But I can't take myself from now to 100 years from now without going through the process. So we might as well try the experiment.
Assuming tomorrow you find unequivocal evidence,
mm-hmm.
and you do your checks and it all checks out, who gets the first phone call or email message?
The donors. That's an absolutely serious answer. These very visionary individuals who have, you know, been willing to put their money into this because they thought it should be done, they'll get the first phone calls.
I think that's a very sensible answer because obviously that will mean that they'll instantly raise more money and allow this project to continue for longer in Australia. And Australians, we're extremely pleased to play host to this fascinating activity, and we're extremely pleased that such an eloquent ambassador for this activity came to enlighten us here. I'm sure you all agree that this was a wonderful lecture, and please stay here for longer, and please, University of Melbourne will fly you down instantly, just as soon as you find something.
Okay.